welcome to On the Mic Podcast. This is your host, Tim Drake. On today's episode, I talked with comedian Christina Wong. Christina and I sat down and talked about her upcoming Los Angeles premiere of her show, The Wong Street Journal, November 12th through the 15th at the Red Cap. It was a lot of fun talking to Christina and finding out more about The Wong Street Journal. Most recently, I had seen Christina on The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore when she had been on there. It was back in June. An awesome panel episode for that. Definitely check that out if you get a chance. If you've never watched The Nightly Show, awesome show as well. But yeah, Christina was a fantastic guest, and it was really fun learning about this show. The Wong Street Journal, it's a story about how she became, as a not-so-white savior from the U.S., became a hip-hop star in northern Uganda. It was really cool to kind of find out how this all came about as she had graduated from UCLA and decided to take on this opportunity to go to Africa and kind of grow a little and see this culture that we aren't very familiar with. Christina has had 5 solo shows and 1 ensemble play that have toured all throughout the U.S. and the U.K. And her most notable touring show is called Wong Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Christina was just, it was so much fun talking to her and kind of understanding the process that she goes through to create these shows. I really wish I was going to be in Los Angeles to see these, so I'm counting on all of you. If you are out in Los Angeles, as I know many of you are, make sure to get out to the Red Cat November 12th to the 15th and go see her show, The Wong Street Journal. Tickets are guaranteed to sell out to this, so make sure you get your tickets fast, because you're going to want to see this. I even brought up, for all of you, those of you that are here in Salt Lake, I talked to Christina about the fact that, you know, we would love to see this show even here in Salt Lake. So, you know, we'll see what we can do. Maybe we can make this happen and bring this show out of Salt Lake as well. But I am really excited for Christina, for everybody that's about to see this show. I'll be posting a couple videos on the website, so you can kind of check those out too and see a little bit of what Christina is up to with this show. See a little bit of the sizzle reel. I mentioned it a few times within the podcast, so that you guys can kind of check that out and see exactly, you know, what this show is like. It is so cool. Her entire set she built herself, sewed herself. It's all made out of felt. It's the entire stock exchange, and it is so awesome. So yeah, you guys have to get out and see this show at the Red Cat, November 12th to the 15th, The Wong Street Journal, premiering in Los Angeles. Today's episode is brought to you by Club 50 West here in Salt Lake City. This week, Dave Koechner from The Office, Anchorman, The Goldbergs, The Scouts, that new Scout movie, I can't remember what it's called, Scouts vs. the Apocalypse or something like that. It's in theaters right now. Dave Koechner's coming to town. So make sure you go check out Dave, Club 50 West. I believe it's 5 shows, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. 7:30 on the Thursday night, and then 7:30 and 9:30, both Friday and Saturday. Club 50 West, downtown Salt Lake. Don't miss your chance to see Dave Koechner. He's a fantastic comedian. And yeah, you're not going to want to miss these shows. Huge thank you again to Christina Wong for taking the time to come on the show and talk about the Wong Street Journal. Again, if you're in Los Angeles, go check these shows out November 12th through the 15th at the Red Cat. Check out the videos on the website. I will also throw a few of them on the Facebook page and tweet some out as well, so you guys can see more of the show and get excited. Get excited to go out there, support Christina, go see the Wong Street Journal, follow her on social media. All of those links as well will be up on the website. So yeah, check that out. Again, go see Dave Koechner this weekend if you're in Salt Lake City at Club 50 West. And yeah, enjoy the show. I'm thrilled to have you. I was watching through a bunch of your videos. I knew I'd seen you on The Nightly Show a few months back. So, and yeah, absolutely loved you on there.
I wrote a funny essay because that format is hard. The multi-panelist, round table thing is tricky because it's like we get these topics ahead of time and just like my head is like rifling for all the jokes I've prepped, but sometimes. Usually what happens is we don't get through half of the topics, and I'm usually more prepared for the other stuff that doesn't come up, and I'm like, active trying to look present, but you're like frantically rifling, at least me, I'm frantically rifling through my head, and I'm very aware that there are not a lot of people in my demographic there, so I feel like I have to rep so far and liberate everyone with my fraction of a 6 minute on television.
How many topics do they give you?
I'm kind of hard on myself, I'm a little hard on myself.
How many topics do they give you for? I mean, it's only like a 8-9 minute segment there.
3 or 4, and we actually got through two, and then one of the segments came up after lunchtime. Like, I think I missed it. It came through an email, but I was in the hotel at that point, and I think I scrolled through the email real fast and must have missed it, and it was about comic books, which I don't really follow. So, I was like, oh, no!
So I know that was, it was an absolutely wonderful segment. So Joe Coy, I know, was on that. We've had Joe Coy out here a few times.
Mike Hogg, he's a nice guy. Totally. My manager was like, oh, I sure told you. Because, like, I guess he was on with one of our other clients on Delphi lately. And he just, boom, like, he'll just vacuum up.
Yeah. So now, how long have you been doing doing comedy and performing?
Are we being recorded right now? I don't even know.
Yeah, this is it.
Oh, we are. Oh, okay. I thought we were doing this like pre-chit chat. Okay. I gotta be more on.
No, you're good. We try to keep it as loose as can be, so it's not. I know, especially when you're doing these press days, it's just
me and like licking the crumbs out of inside my mouth. I'm like going, okay, this is a game mode, and I'm like, oh shit, here we are.
No, you're totally fine. I like trying to keep it loose with everybody, because I know especially when you're doing these press days, it's just, you know, you get hit just with the same questions over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So how many are you guys doing? You know, kind of leading up to the to some of the Wong Street Journal.
Well, KPCC, which is the public radio station, they're gonna come to a rehearsal. So we didn't have a rehearsal schedule, but we're gonna have not like a fake rehearsal, but we'll have something that looks like a rehearsal that looks real poignant. So whoever sees it up there with audio can be like, wow, and like report on it. So they're going to interview the week up, and then I'm going to Orange County today. It's an interview with, I think it's like a Vietnamese channel. I think they sent me out to the Asian press list, so I have that. I'll be interesting to see if those actually translate into audience members. I always feel like I don't know if anyone watches those and is all like, okay, let's go experimental theater comedy and drive across the orange curtain to go see something. And then I have like a young interview on Monday. So it's getting pretty crazy. And I premiered the show in San Francisco, and I actually have not rehearsed or touched it since August. So I get a week to like basically put on this old pair of pants and then do the show.
So I wish I was going to be in LA to see this show. I was watching through the sizzle reel, and I mean, I am so intrigued to see the full production.
It is amazing. Like, I showed my entire set. I don't know what other comedians are showing their sets, but I showed my entire set. I showed a replica of the New York Stock Exchange. And a lot of what I'm playing around with is where I was a little over 2 years ago. I had been touring a show about depression and suicide. I still am doing an excerpt of it in late November, so it's going to be like over 8-9 years that this show is lit. That's a long time to tour that same show, and I was just losing my mind and just becoming really disenchanted with live theater. And I was just like, what am I doing? I'm like a human VCR, it's really tricky to figure out how to like both make a living and transition out or just make it gratifying. And I found myself pulling the Dave Chappelle, and I was like, I'm going to Africa. I'm going to do this. I would do. I mean, it's different for him. He obviously has blood ties to the continent. But like, I was just like, I don't know. I've never had this experience. Like, when I finished school, I was just trying to work right away as a performer, so I never got the, like, Peace Corps experience, and I was like, well, this is my YOLO moment. I'm just going to go, and I found myself volunteering with an organization in northern Uganda, which is where Joseph Kony, people familiar with Kony 2012,
yeah.
He's a warlord, and there was basically a huge civil war that more or less ended in 2006. And so they're in recovery mode, and it was something that I never thought I would do as a comedian. It's interesting, because when you're used to, like, making jokes all the time and say sarcastic things, like, it is completely different. Like, my brain was on overload, but it was, like, it was very tricky to figure out where to pull the easy punches, because there are no easy punches. Like, if anything, it's kind of eye-opening in terms of, like, how little Americans who've never been to Africa understand about Africa and people, and I really had to, like, hold back my joke maker and just sit and observe, and it was just, it's so uncomfortable. And I actually was posting kind of plenty of things that were really dealing with how uncomfortable or just shocking everything was, and shocking in how different it was. And I think it was also interesting because I do a lot of work here, write a lot about race and social justice issues, and to suddenly go from that person is always calling people out in America on social media to being the evil white person in Africa. And there I would be referred to as Mzungu, so it's not like I was just suddenly white, but the people would just very casually be like, when they see your white skin, like, what is happening? Like, I got to the point that when, like, the town drunk came up to me doing karate, I was actually like, you know, there's normally, of course, like, super offensive out here if someone who isn't Chinese, or even is Chinese, just starts going, hi-ya, and, like, coming towards me, thinking, okay, it's a Chinese person, I'm going to do that. But it, like, got to the point that when kids would be like, Chinese, or, like, the town drunk would come at me doing karate, I was, like, just, like, so happy that I was like, oh, I'm Chinese again. You know, just, like, because I began to really feel very privileged and very white in that sense that I was just, like, so kind of clueless about how to best interact with people in ways that didn't create more problems. So that's the show, is like navigating a lot of that awkwardness. But I also made a rap album while I was there. So 3 nights in, I was just wandering around in the street looking for food, met these boys at a food stand, and I thought that they were the gay community. I thought they were for the underground gay community. And they were not, and they invited me into this dark room behind them, the shack, pretty much, and, like, thinking, oh, I have to support my, you know, my queer brothers and sisters, or brothers, at least. I go in there, and I end up making this hit rap album, which still plays on the radio in northern Uganda.
Oh, wow.
It's a very, yeah, like, I kicked off that career in my 30s, you know? And this is a pretty crazy show that I had to spend a long time thinking about what's the best way to create humor around this that doesn't make them the butt of the jokes, and really think thoughtfully about how Americans have been taught to look at Africa in terms of, like, Save the Children commercials or just like, oh, like, that's where you go to adopt babies. And really, like, taking a step back from that and recognizing where we are kind of the problem. And we're looking at, you know, that part of the world that way is not actually helping anybody.
So how did audiences kind of first react when they saw, you know, that you were taking the social approach when you started testing out the show?
The show, I think, has gone over really well. I'm getting several kinds of reactions. One is that people who know me from my past work or know my, like, a lot of my material that's gone more viral is what I call the low-hanging fruit. So it's like my public obsession with Jeremy Lin and trying to marry Jeremy Lin. I when I get asked to do shows and I don't have a lot of tech time, I get dressed as a giant vagina and I do stand up. And then I also have written a lot of essays about yellow fever, which is the phenomenon of white men who only date Asian women. None of that is in the show, right? And so I'll have, like, in San Francisco, I had audience members going, oh, I thought this was going to be about white guys who love Asian women. And it was about Uganda. And I kind of love that I tricked. Yeah, I love that I, like, tricked a bunch of, tricked a lot of Asian Americans into coming to see the show about Uganda. So there's that dynamic is happening. I think when I was in Uganda, what was really tricky was I was uploading my photos to Facebook. I guess, you know, things just feel, at least for most Americans, I would think, who've never been there before, I describe it as this sort of a precarious feeling because you just sense how different you are. And you, like, for me, I sensed, like, how much more I had than everyone else. And I felt like a little bit of a target. Nothing happened. I mean, I almost got pickpocketed, but nothing happened. And so I was just uploading my photos quickly to Facebook in case, you know, my camera disappeared or whatever. And I didn't have a lot of time to caption my photos and really give context for everything I saw, because the Wi-Fi is so limited out there. Like, I would catch a Wi-Fi signal, and it was just, oh, and I, it was like, because there's always power outages. And people had a lot of people who I'd worked with in the past are no longer Facebook friends with me because they had problems with how I was captioning the photos, or they would just, you know, it's like when you see Facebook, you're not reading the whole narrative. And I think some of, you know, a lot of it was internalized in my head, like this, like, idea that I had suddenly become white was really tricky, and people were really offended that I was referring to myself as white, as if I didn't care anymore about being Asian or enjoyed it a lot, enjoyed this position of privilege and power over the people I was with. It was tricky, because, like, I look back at my photos and I'm offended. Like, I'm like, wow, there's a lot of unnecessary photos of kids. But the thing is, like, kids, I was like a one-woman Disneyland out there. Like, kids would, like, run up to me and they're like, take my photo, and take the picture and show them. You know, and they just wanted to be able to see themselves and stuff. And so I just uploaded everything. It's tricky, I guess, I'm glad that happened in terms of the show, because it really forced me to think super thoughtfully about, you know, I don't want to do the, like, modern day version of the World's Fair where I'm like, look at the natives. That's not okay, you know. but it's tricky, like, because I don't know how else to bring in American audience to this work that doesn't have some element of displaying. And I'm trying to, I would like to think that I would approach this a little bit more thoughtfully than Chelsea Handler when she went to Uganda. And it was just a lot of jokes about could catch AIDS and those kind of stuff.
I mean, it comes across, you know, as a lot more smarter satire, more or less what you're doing than, you know, just poking fun and, you know, really, you know, hitting that low-hanging fruit and making it where you're still addressing that social issue and being able to make people, you know, laugh and then approach it a lot more thoughtfully than they might have previously.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's absolutely... my mom, like, called me last night. She was upset because she's like, do you need attention really badly? Because I've been, you know, I've just been hardcore pushing the show. So I, like, posted a video of me getting a pap smear. It's just, like, my face. it is so awkward. It's like, are you enjoying yourself? Or are you hating this? You know, it's a weird combo of both, because if someone, if no one is familiar with what a pap smear is, it's like these duck tongs called a speculum that are stuck in your vajayjay, and they crank you open, and then they scrape some of your inner wall, and they make sure you don't have cancer and other things. And I was just like, what are you doing? And she just was like, you know, you post so much about sex and all these things. I just think that the show is so good and everyone's going to think that this is a show about sex, and then they won't want to come. And I'm like, are you kidding? Your friends won't want to come. But you're usually not, you know, my mom is not my target demographic. I don't know. I think where the point is, where there is some truth, is that, like, it's tricky to bring an audience into more in-depth work when you kind of, as a not quite, like, super millionaire comedian, super comedian, like, performance, what's it called, famous performance artist, I can't just, like, say my name and everyone shows up. I've got to, like, throw all this stuff out for the groundlings to come scramble for.
Yeah.
You know, throw some peanuts out, some low-hanging fruit. But, yeah, it's tricky, because that is actually the work that people will experience the least, the live stuff, and that's where I really get into some hard issues.
So now, when you mentioned that, you know, this was kind of right after you had finished school at UCLA, what was it that you had studied at UCLA that kind of even prompted, you know, the thought to go out and do this?
Oh, my God. I was, I thought that in high school that I might want to be a theater major, because I was like, oh, that's the next logical thing to be an actor. And I shopped out that major a little, and I was like, I don't like the students in this program. Or I just felt like it was really competitive, and I didn't feel like, for me as a woman of color, that there'd be a lot for me to do. And I felt like I'd be constantly in a state of competing, and with no guarantee that this degree would lead to a lot of work. So I decided to stack up as many liberal arts degrees as I could in the 4 years I was there. So I did an English Lit major with a specialization in creative writing, and I also did a major called World Arts and Cultures, which only exists at UCLA, and it's pretty broad. It's everything that fits under world arts and culture, Their choreographers in the major, their documentary filmmakers in the major. Actually, Carrie Ann Inaba from Dancing with the Stars was finishing up her undergrad degree when I was a student there.
Oh, wow.
And then years later, she became a famous judge. But we all knew her because she was a fly girl on In Living Color, and it was like, she was so, like, wowy in that way. And then I did a minor in Asian American Studies, and I was really influenced by a lot of the guest artists that came to visit our campus and the Chicano theater movement. I took a Chicano theater class in the theater department as I was shopping the major out. And I had never, I always thought theater was supposed to be boring, right? Because it was like, we'd go on these trips to go see plays, and I would always inevitably like pass out watching it. But I was thinking, oh, I have to like this because it's theta. And what I liked about Chicano theater was used to address issues and help organize farm workers. And I never thought that theater was useful in that way, and that it couldn't, it wasn't just like fancy pants actors that could have access to it, but it was something that could be used by the people. And we had a lot of guest artists that would come to UCLA who would do like really kind of weird experimental stuff that I didn't even know existed. Like they would cover themselves in flour and then, you know, dancing in the men's shower, the commentary of the history of gay sex that happened in that shower. And I was just like, yeah, this is what I want to do for a living. I want to make crazy performance art. I want to jump on mattresses and then eat Jell-O and cover myself in paint, and it'll be a commentary on colonialism. You know, like that. I had thought that it was a legit job because I had all these professors who seemed to be, you know, procuring their living doing it, and as I find, it is actually super hard, and not that many people watch it, but it's still, like, how I've been trained to think about the world and this sort of interdisciplinary approach, which is sort of why my shows don't look like straight stand-up. It's me, like, making and sewing things on stage and showing off these big visual props and getting into pretty intensely deep commentary about imperialism.
So, and even all of that, I mean, I know, at least personally, that's always, you know, some of the comedy and performance art that always kind of, at least for me, reaches me on a deeper level, because of the fact that when you have, you know, so many just amazing visual presentations, and then you are able to liken it, you know, just to the ridiculous things in our everyday life, I mean, it's great to be able to relate to it, and then just soak in everything in the surrounding. That's, I think, at least for me, like I said, with performance art, that just has made me fall in love with it.
Yeah, what I like about performance art versus just straight stand-up, I think all of the culture around stand-up, it is shifting. Like, I don't think that people are going to comedy clubs the way they used to with the two-drink minimum, and it's all these little small alt spaces and living room spaces where, like, you know, people just pack in BYOB, and there's all the weird stuff happening. Like, I find, like, going to stand-up shows really exhausting. Like, sometimes they're really good, but maybe it's an L.A. thing where there's just enough. Like, it feels like just so much work to go. And, I guess what I like about performance art, like, even though performance art can be god-awful, really boring, is at least, like, I'm getting images to think about, and it hits me in the sort of cerebral level. There's the connections of the storytelling is not necessarily all language-based. And I enjoy that, and I enjoy thinking about things not just in terms of writing and persona. I think stand-up is an amazing form, but it's exhausting.
Yeah, and I know personally, even, I mean, especially out in LA, some of the rooms that I've become, you know, just, they're the must-go-to spot for me whenever I'm out there, have been like Meltdown, because it's not just a basic stand-up room. I mean, you know, they'll have, you know, a book event or, you know, a random sketch show. I mean, it's always something different, and there's no, you know, two-drink minimum, and half the shows there even end up being free, where it's just, you know, come enjoy this performance. And even some of those over at UCB or Iowa West, I mean, they're always, it's so much more about the art than it is about, you know, packing people into a comedy club and, you know, charging an arm and a leg for a couple of drinks.
Yeah. Oh, God, and then there's always that last round when the waiter comes and you have to sign off on your tab, and you're still trying to listen to the spat. I just find it's, like, so much work.
Yeah.
And it feels kind of, like, punishing, you know, when I come and ask you what your second order is and whatever. And I Yeah, that meltdown space. I don't get out there enough, but I did the Rich podcast there. I love this like storytelling.
Yeah.
That is picking up. Because I used to just feel like what I did was so weird, because when I got out of school in the early aughts, like, it was just like comedy over here, weird art over there, and then I'm watching more and more alt comedy, and I'm like, this is not that different than what I was making. It's that weird, blurry space between this character, this person coming out in a costume, they're telling this weird joke, and then someone else shows up on stage. Like, I love that it's a lot more blurry, and that hopefully alt comedy just becomes comedy. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think it's time that it finally kind of meshes together. I know while I've studied with Second City, you know, some of the teachers there have really encouraged that, even of, you know, yeah, everybody's done this. What can you do to broaden that, to make it, you know, more of an alt comedy type piece instead of just, you know, a everyday comedy piece you could see from any comedian in any room anywhere?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I wish I had more confidence around it early on. In the last few years, I was like, wait a second. Like, it was so tricky. Like, people had such a narrow idea of what a comedian was that I always just tell people what the performance art is, but that would scare people because they assume that I would just be menstruating on myself, which I do in my former shows. But, like, yeah, like, I think, you know, the response I would tend to get is, tell me a joke. For a comedian, you know, or this assumption that I was supposed to be okay with misogynistic and racist humor, but you're a comedian, just why do you have to be so serious about stuff? And it's just like, is that what comedians are? Just people who just eat sexist and racist humor and laugh at sexist and racist jokes? But I'm happy to see that a lot of the comedy that was formerly presented on college campuses that was like sponsored by like a Black student union or an Asian student union is now like I'm seeing it on television, and that's people like Hari Kondabolu or like Kamau Bell, like doing the humor that like used to just really feel like it was just buried in the corner of a room is now, I think, overly just being more front and center.
Yeah, and I think as society, as we start to, I mean, it's a very slow process, but I think, especially with the younger generation, we can see that they're becoming more and more socially conscious, and I think that's what's going to finally give it that push to make it, you know, a regular, everyday thing.
It's going to take comedy to really take, I mean, I don't know if you've seen this video from Spring Valley High of this black girl, who's in her class, and I guess she was on her cell phone. I don't think that justifies a cop turning her upside down on the chair and pulling her out of this chair in front of her classmates and then, like, arresting her. It was just, like, this level of, I didn't even know I had this sort of, I think I had this, trauma trigger, and, like, I didn't know I had it until I watched this horrific video, and there were literally times that are so insane that one way we're going to, you know, give these moments power is comedians are going to step in and have to find ways to create inviting ways to comment on this stuff. And I'm hoping that's what I'm doing in terms of talking about Uganda. Like, I don't want to be like, ha ha, poor Africans. Like, I would never do that. But it's what I have been thinking about. It's like this very interesting responsibility to consider that I have the stage, I have the space, and so how do I want to bring the, what do I want to get my audience thinking about? And how do I want them to not just, like, laugh and laugh and laugh and be comfortable, but, like, be uncomfortable, but also be challenged to think, and then laugh some more, you know?
Yeah, and from what I've seen, you know, from the sizzle reel of the Wong Street Journal, I think you've done a fantastic job of that, and, you know, I hope that everybody, you know, continues to get out and see the show and takes a lot away from it.
Yeah, it'll be at the Red Cat in Los Angeles. If you've got LA listeners, November 12th or 15th, then they can go to redcat.org for that. And I'll also be in Philadelphia in April 2016, Miami in January 2016, and I think right now Minneapolis is in the works for March. So it's slowly coming, but it's coming.
So we'll make sure to get the word out to everybody in LA for sure.
I was in Utah. Is the one town state that I am not anticipating a large number of invites coming soon, but who knows.
So I mean, Joe Coy always comes out and rakes it in. So, I mean, I think it would actually do very well out here, especially downtown Salt Lake. It's it's a much more progressive area of the state that I honestly think it would do. I think it would do very well.
I would love to play Salt Lake. It's true because this is where I wish I was more of like, just all I need is the microphone because I have all so much stuff. So it's a little tricky. Into a space, I gotta set up the stuff. But it's worth it. The stuff is gorgeous. The sets, the props, all that stuff.
So I'll definitely bring it up to some of the club owners out here because I think it'd be a great show to bring out here.
That would be amazing. Thank you.
Of course. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today, Christina. I'm glad to learn more about the show and hopefully as I head back out to LA in a couple months, or we'll be able to connect out there and hopefully see some more of your performances.
I would love to meet.
Yeah, and instead of the ominous over the phone.
On a date. It's just so intimate. It's so oddly intimate. I'm like, suddenly I wasn't performing and I was performing, and now I still feel like we're just chit-chatting, like we're revving up to the interview.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always kind of a weird space. I know Kurt Brownoller had been on the show a while back, and we've interacted online and stuff, but we had never met until like 3 weeks ago. And that was like a year ago that he was on the show.
Wow. Now I'm always going to wonder if I'm being recorded on these calls. I called Joe Coy on my cog. I think he knows that, though. So I don't...
So, well, thank you so much, Christina. And again, best of luck with everything. And hopefully, you know, all the shows at the Red Cat will be packed for you.
I hope so. Thank you so much.
Not a problem. You have a great rest of your day, Christina.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
Bye-bye.